the headlines, Beijing accuses Washington of paranoid delusion after the U.S. Senate passed a bill aimed at countering what it calls the surging economic threat from China. The U.S. Secretary of State says he expects hundreds of anti-Tehran sanctions to remain in place even after the revival of the Iran nuclear deal. And the mayor of the Canadian city of London, where four members of a Muslim family were killed, condemns the bloodshed as an act of hatred and Islamophobia. Hello and welcome, everybody. China has strongly condemned the U.S. for approving a bill aimed at countering what Washington sees as Chinese technology threat. In a statement, China's parliament accused the U.S. of, quote, paranoid delusion. It said the bill smeared China's domestic and foreign policies and interfered in its internal affairs. On Tuesday, the U.S. Senate approved a sweeping industrial policy bill to boost the country's ability to compete with Chinese technology. The bill would authorize about $190 billion for provisions to strengthen U.S. technology and research. The bill must now pass the House of Representatives to be sent to the White House for President Joe Biden to sign into law. International and independent China strategist Andrew K.P. Long joins us now on the line from Hong Kong. Mr. Long, welcome to the program. Let's talk about the recent developments. China has accused the U.S. of having paranoid delusion. Walk us through these statements.
Well, I think there's a bit of rhetoric on either side. On the side of the United States, it's portraying China as an existential threat, particularly as an a kind of authoritarian demon that's going to unsettle the Western liberal order. But then on the Chinese side, I think that really China should be proud that the United States feels that it's falling behind in certain high-tech area of the 21st century. For example, 5G, for example, the Internet of Things and artificial intelligence and quantum computing. So if not, then the United States would not have spent so much money and also so much bipartisan effort to try to catch up with China. On the other hand, China, though, even though it may be leading in certain fields, there's no doubt that the United States still retains the high water mark in technology worldwide. But of course, the perception is that China is catching up there, and then China's economy is sometime in the future, in the not too distant future, is going to exceed the United States as the world's largest economy. So I think that this is a bit of rhetoric on both sides, but I think it's a genuine effort to boost America's technological lead, particularly in those areas which I've just mentioned.
Right. Mr. Nguyen, what can you tell us about this industrial policy bill that was passed by the U.S. Senate, and what kind of a response are you expecting to see from Beijing in that regard?
Well, I think that Beijing will make some song and dance about it. But then, on the other hand, it is, will serve as a kind of impetus to China's own efforts to grow its own kind of critical technologies, because with the trade war and with the kind of 360-degree pushback by the United States against China, there are certain bottlenecks. For example, Huawei is the high-end computer chip. They are in control in the hands of only one or two producers, and also the machine producing this kind of high-end chip is in control of a European country, i.e. Holland. And then without these high-end chips, China would struggle to grow its own 5G and other technologies. And that's why Huawei is now almost pushed into the corner. So I think that the American bill, in some way, would serve as an impetus to China to grow its own technologies. And all in all, that would suggest a kind of direct competition between two great powers in the technology field. Apart from other fields, in military, in ideology, I mean, it's across the board kind of competition and rivalry. As far as the United States relationship is concerned, I think that the new Secretary of State, Blinken, put it quite well. And he said that the United States must compete with China when it should be, and also cooperate with China when it can be, but also confront China when it must be. So I think the reason you see that there is both competition and confrontation across the board.
Andrew Capian Loing joining us from Hong Kong. Thank you very much for your comments, sir. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says hundreds of sanctions against Iran could remain in place even if the 2015 nuclear deal is revived.
I would anticipate that even in the event of a return to compliance with the JCPOA, hundreds of sanctions would remain in place, including sanctions imposed by the Trump administration. If they are not inconsistent with the JCPOA, they will remain unless and until Iran's behavior changes.
Blinken was addressing a Senate committee meeting on the recent talks in Vienna on the revival of the Iran nuclear deal. He said at this stage the U.S. does not know whether Iran is willing to do what's needed to come back into compliance. The United States withdrew from the International Court in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. In response, Iran began rolling back its nuclear commitments. Tehran and the remaining parties are now engaged in talks in Vienna to revive the agreement. Tehran has time and again said it will return to compliance only after the U.S. removes all sanctions verifiably. Political commentator Tim Anderson says the U.S. approach toward the nuclear deal revival efforts shows its lack of determination to return to the accord.
You know, I think Mr. Blinken has clarified two things. One is that the JCPOA discussions are not really to do with Iran's nuclear industry. It's all about trying to sideline Iran's influence in the region. Iran, having the high moral ground, doesn't really need to do anything. It says it's waiting on the U.S. to come back to compliance in a practical sense. And on the other hand, the U.S. perhaps is trying to provoke Iran to move away from it and therefore gain some kudos, perhaps with the Europeans. But really, it seems to be going nowhere.
Iran's foreign minister says his country is ready to facilitate peace talks in Yemen and Afghanistan to promote regional peace and stability. Mohammad Javad Zarif says he has made the comment during separate meetings in Tehran with UN special envoys to Yemen and Afghanistan. The top Iranian diplomat described as fruitful his talks with Martin Griffiths on Yemen and Jean Arnois on Afghanistan. Zarif told them that peace processes must be owned by all Yemenis and Afghans without what he called external imposition. The UN is trying to bring warring sides in Yemen to the negotiating table to end a Saudi-led conflict, which started in 2015. In Afghanistan, the government is in talks with the Taliban militant group to hammer out a peace deal after years of bloody violence. And a delegation from Oman is in the Yemeni capital as part of efforts to find a peaceful solution to the years-long war on Yemen. The delegation has held talks with the leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Abdel Malik al-Houthi, and the head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Abdel Latif al-Washali, has more from Sana'a.
To find a solution to the years-long war on Yemen, an Omani delegation has visited Sana'a and held talks with the leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Abdel Malik al-Houthi, and the head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council. During the talks, Houthi held Oman for its efforts and stance beside Yemenis since the beginning of the Saudi war on Yemen.
The Omani delegation is exerting efforts, but its success is possible when the Saudi-led coalition admits it's failed in Yemen. However, it seems Saudi Arabia is still trying to impose pressure on Sana'a by tightening the siege to gain what it has failed to achieve in the war. We appreciate what our Omani brothers are doing and hope that they will succeed in ending the suffering of our people.
Observers say there's good progress in the humanitarian situation and Sana'a Airport might be reopened soon, as well as Hodeidah Port, which means that the fuel ships will be allowed to enter the country. They believe that the success of Oman's delegation will relieve the suffering of millions of Yemenis. to meet the political leadership and discuss the possible ways to lift the siege imposed on Yemenis by Saudi Arabia. Since the beginning of 2015, the Saudi war has killed thousands of civilians, including women and children, and pushed the war-torn country to the brink of famine. Yemenis believe that the Omani delegation is finally succeeding in removing all impediments to their access to food and fuel. They say lifting the blockade is the first real step toward a nationwide ceasefire and the end of the brutal war on their country. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
A Shia Bahraini political prisoner has died from COVID-19 after he was denied medical care. Hossein Barakat was in a coma due to severe lung infection and lack of oxygen. His health conditions deteriorated as the Bahraini Interior Ministry and prison officials refused to release him, even temporarily. Bahraini officials kept the family of Barakat unaware of his health condition. Some 200 political prisoners in Bahraini jails have been infected by COVID since the pandemic began. Activists say those inmates face medical negligence that is seen as part of widespread discrimination against the country's Shia majority by the ruling Al-Khalifa regime. Syrian media say the country's air defenses have intercepted Israeli missile attacks on southern and central areas. Earlier, we were joined by our Damascus correspondent, Muhammad Ali, to get the details on the story.
An official military source confirmed what happened, saying in a statement that Israel carried out an aggression attacking Syria at about 11:36 p.m. local time from Lebanese airspace, attacking several positions in central and southern Syria. The military source did not specify what exactly was targeted, but definitely it was the targets were military sites, perhaps, for the Syrian army. According to the Syrian army statement, air defenses intercepted the enemy missiles, shooting down some of them, while the attack in general led to only material damages. Of course, this is not the first time that this happens. Hundreds of Israeli attacks were carried out in the past 10 or 11 years, and usually following such attacks, the Syrian Foreign Ministry sends letters to the United Nations Security Council and Secretary General informing them officially on what happened and calling on the international body to take decisive and fast measures, actually, in order to prevent future attacks, because this is an attack which is against international law, that undermines international law and the UN Charter.
Mourners have held a vigil in Canada to remember four members of a Muslim family killed in a hate-motivated attack on Sunday. The event was held in the capital, Ottawa, in East Central Ontario province. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was in attendance, too. He expressed sorrow over the tragic incident and said the thoughts and prayers of all Canadians are with the victims. Trudeau said his government would take action but gave no details. Other mourners attending the event expressed grief and described the attack as a horrific crime.
I want every single one of us, from the highest levels of government, from our elected officials, to the everyday commoner that exists in our country, in our province, in our city, in our community, to make a commitment, a solemn promise, that you will do everything within your capacity to fight the scourge of racism, of discrimination, of xenophobia in any form that it exists.
The mayor of London and Ontario province, where the crime happened, issued a statement on Twitter. Ed Holder called the crime an act of mass murder rooted in unspeakable hatred. He said, "This act of Islamophobia must be followed by acts of compassion." On Sunday, four members of a Muslim family were killed in the Canadian city when a man rammed them with his pickup truck. Police say they were targeted because of their religion. For more insight on that story, we're now joined by Chairman of the Fianz Royal Commission Committee, Abdul Razzaq, joining us from Wellington. Mr. Razzaq, welcome to the program. Let's talk about this overall, the horrific crime that took place in that vigil. The crime was described as a hate crime and an act of Islamophobia. How significant is that?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, I don't think it was just a crime. I don't think it was just a hate crime. This was a calculated act of terror. Let's call it what it is. It is terrorism in its absolute blatant form. And this thing, whether it's four people, Muslims who have died, or the 51 who passed away, Shaheed in Wellington, this is terrorism as a result of right-wing extremism and the unabated, what we call it, Islamophobia or the securitization of Islam. This has to stop.
And in terms of Canada right now, the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, has mentioned measures. He wasn't very specific. Where do they go from here, in your opinion?
Well, all I can say in New Zealand, what the government has done, government instituted a Royal Commission. And as a result of the Royal Commission, there have been some significant steps taken in legislative areas, social cohesion area, education area, and number of fronts. It has to be taken at a very serious level. A very senior minister is now coordinating all these activities. See, in other words, it needs a multi-pronged, multifaceted, and a coordinated approach for all what they call over here, what we call an all of government with an all of society approach. It cannot be done in isolation. It cannot be just one program or another. It's across the board. This is what we are doing in New Zealand.
All right, Mr. Abdulrazzaq, joining us from Wellington. We're going to leave it there. Thank you for your comments, sir.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
Mitsubishi Corporation, its Japanese engineering affiliate, Chiyoda, and five local companies are working on the development of a sustainable hydrogen economy in Singapore using Chiyoda hydrogen storage and transportation technology. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Scott Foster, an analyst with Lightstream Research, Tokyo, entitled Japan Incorporation Driving Towards the Hydrogen Energy Future. The article was published by Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us to hear more about the details. when Warren Buffett's investment company, Berkshire Hathaway, announced last August that it had acquired more than 5% of the five largest Japanese general trading companies, including Mitsubishi Corporation, Itochu, Mitsui & Co., Marubeni, and Sumitomo Corporation, most failed to notice that Buffett was buying into coal-fired power projects. Within 3 months, a group of institutional investors led by Nordi Asset Management of Finland sent a letter to Mitsubishi Corporation requesting that it abandon its Vang Ang 2 coal-fired power plant project in Vietnam. Friends of the Earth, Greta Thunberg, and Japanese environmentalists piled on, but to no avail. However, in February, Mitsubishi Corporation announced its withdrawal from the Vinh Thanh 3 coal-fired power plant project, also in Vietnam, and said that Vang Ang 2 would be its last such project. Both Itochu and Mitsui & Co. have also announced plans to exit thermal coal. Marubeni and Sumitomo Corp. plan to do so except in cases when no other source of power is available and where the most advanced emission reduction technologies are used. So, what will they do instead? These are large companies with annual turnover ranging from $48 billion to $146 billion before and presumably after the COVID-19 pandemic, operating in a wide range of businesses from resources and energy to infrastructure, industry, IT, and finance. They have no shortage of projects. And they're all involved in hydrogen energy. For example, Mitsubishi Corp., its Japanese engineering affiliate Chiyoda, and five local companies are working on the development of a sustainable hydrogen economy in Singapore using Chiyoda hydrogen storage and transportation technology. Itochu plans to build one of the world's largest liquid hydrogen plants in Japan with Air Liquide to supply fuel cell vehicles. Air Liquide already operates hydrogen fueling stations in Japan. Mitsui & Co. has entered into an agreement with Hiringa Energy to pursue commercial hydrogen energy projects in New Zealand. It has also invested $25 million in First Element Fuel, the largest developer and operator of hydrogen stations in California. Marubeni is working with Siemens and Master to develop hydrogen and other alternative energy technologies in Abu Dhabi. Sumitomo Corp. and Japanese engineering company JGC are planning to build a facility in Australia that would produce hydrogen using solar-powered electrolysis. These and many other Japanese companies are also getting involved in hydrogen energy through consortia and industry associations. Recently, the Hydrogen Energy Supply Chain, HECS, pilot project in Victoria, Australia, announced that the world's first coal-to-hydrogen production process had begun operations. The HESC project is being implemented by a consortium, including from Japan, Kawasaki Heavy Industries, J-Power, Gas Distributor, Iwatani, Marubeni, and Sumitomo Corp., supported by the Victorian, Australian, and Japanese governments. Last October, the Japan Hydrogen Association was established by Mitsui & Co., Iwatani, Kawasaki Heavy Industries, Japanese Oil and Energy Company, ENEOS, Coop Steel, Mitsui Financial Group, Kansai Electric Power, and Toshiba. It aims to form international alliances and develop global hydrogen supply chains. In December, those companies were joined by Toyota and shipping company K-Line. In addition, K-Line, Iwatani, Kansai Electric Power, Nomura Shipbuilding, the Development Bank of Japan, and Tokyo University of Marine Science and Technology have formed a group to promote hydrogen fuel cell-powered ships. Mauro Beni is also leading the COP Kansai Hydrogen Utilization Council, which aims to develop a regional hydrogen supply chain in West Central Japan. The council includes many of the companies listed above, plus power plant equipment maker Mitsubishi Power, general contractor Obayashi, and Shell Japan. The Japanese are keen on industry associations, which often overlap. It sounds bureaucratic, but ensures a degree of coordination that would be hard to achieve otherwise, as well as logistical and financial support for worldwide operations. Iwatani recently announced plans to produce hydrogen with Stanwell Corporations in Queensland, Australia, and to build 7 new hydrogen fueling stations in California with Toyota. With interest high in Toyota's latest developments in hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicles, it's worth pointing out that Honda and Nissan also make hydrogen FCEVs. Toyota began financing the construction of hydrogen fueling stations for passenger cars and other vehicles in California in 2014. Honda quickly followed suit. Toyota, Honda, and Nissan have been supporting the development of hydrogen station infrastructure in Japan since 2015. ENEOS now plans to install hydrogen pumps at its gas stations, a first for Japan and one that points toward a nationwide build-out. ENEOS operates some 13,000 service stations from Hokkaido to Okinawa. Available data show that there are now some 135 hydrogen fueling stations in Japan, 150-plus in Europe, more than half of them in Germany, about 80 in North America, more than half of them in California, and more than 70 in China. The list of hydrogen power applications continues to grow. Buses powered by Toyota hydrogen fuel cells are being introduced in Japan and Portugal. East Japan railway company Hitachi and Toyota are working on train engines powered by hydrogen fuel cells and storage batteries, and construction equipment maker Komatsu plans to develop hydrogen-powered mining trucks. There are questions about hydrogen energy, most of them having to do with its relatively high cost, how it can be transported efficiently and safely, and the potentially negative environmental consequences of hydrogen production. All of these problems are currently the subject of research and feasibility studies. Hydrogen fuel is currently several times more expensive than gasoline, but the price should come down as the volume produced and sold goes up, which will happen as Japan moves from 135 hydrogen stations now to several thousands in ENEOS network alone. Transport is made economical by liquefaction and compression. Scott Foster wrote, "As with gasoline, safety is a matter of pipe, tank, and fueling system engineering." At one trade show I attended in the United States, an industry representative explained that this company's hydrogen fuel tank could withstand an attack by 50-caliber machine gun. Hidden environmental costs are a concern with most, if not all, alternatives to fossil fuels. In the case of hydrogen, the issues getting the most attention are the source of energy for electrolysis and potential carbon emissions from the coal to hydrogen production process. The former is easily monitored. The latter will either be dealt with efficiently or the technology will fail economically as well as politically. As for competition, KMPG's Global Automotive Executive Survey of 2017 found that 78% of 1,000 senior auto executives asked thought that hydrogen FCEVs would eventually outperform battery-powered EVs. Elon Musk is not one of them, but Toyota, Honda, and Nissan are pursuing both battery and hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. Some industry observers believe that the cost of new technology and infrastructure will prove to be too high, but both government support and the long, but incomplete list of companies mentioned in this article suggests otherwise. In any case, Warren Buffett investments have done well so far. As of March 12, the share prices of Japan's five biggest trading companies were up 45% to 99% from their 52-week lows.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Ashrafi. A new report by the United Nations Human Rights Council spotlights growing Islamophobia and excessive surveillance of Muslims in countries around the world, urging the countries to do more to combat Islamophobia. A report by the Institute of Social Policy and Understanding finds that American Muslims are the most likely faith group to report facing religious discrimination at about 60% over the past 5 years. Now, two recent incidents in Canada and Austria shed more light on the rising Islamophobia. In the Canadian city of London, the driver slammed his car into a Muslim family, killing four people. And last month in Austria, the government released a controversial national map of Islam and placed signs across the country warning of nearby mosques that may constitute a threat. Now, following the release of the map, attacks against Muslims have increased in Austria rapidly. In tonight's debate show, we'll be discussing with our panelists the reasons for the rise of Islamophobia. Now, without much further ado, let's get right to business. So let's invite our guest. We have founder of the initiative by Austrian Muslims, Tarafa Bagajati in Vienna, and also director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, is joining us from Tirana. Good to have you both on the show. Now, starting with Tarafa, the Vienna government's recent steps to contain so-called political Islam have put 800,000 Muslims in danger by triggering new violence on Austria's Muslim minority. You know, mosques on government maps signify threat, and this has dramatically raised racist attacks in Austria last month. What has caused this to happen in that country?
The problem is in Austria, especially, and also in the Western countries, that the Islamophobic, the former racism against Muslim, is going to be within the raising of right extremism and right-wing parties, a political program having more voices from the people in the election. And this is a very dangerous dimension what we are facing today as European Muslims. And this land card, what we had, this Islam card from our government, was a very problematic indication actually against the Muslim community, giving the whole community under pressure, under observation, and also under mistrust of the whole community. And this is directly against the social cohesion in the country and also against the traditional Austrian way dealing with Islam, which is based on dialogue and respecting each other's.
Okay, now, Zafar Bangash, let's take a look at Canada now. That's where you live. Apart from this recent Ontario hate crime, 4 years ago we also had a 27-year-old white supremacist bursting into Quebec City Mosque, gunning down six worshippers there and wounding some other people. So what's behind such crimes against Muslim community in Canada?
Well, in Canada, there is a large body of opinion that exists on the social media. and they propagate all kinds of hatred against Muslims in particular, because it also fits into over the last 20 or so years since the attacks of 9/11, when Muslim countries were targeted and bombed and destroyed. And so these right-wing groups in Canada and indeed in the United States, and now of course this has become a global phenomenon because all of these internet or social media platforms are interlinked with each other, and they radicalize people, particularly youth, in spreading hatred against the Muslims. So these attacks that we have witnessed 2 days ago or 3 days ago in London, Ontario, a small sleepy town where a family of five were mowed down by a pickup truck. Four of them were killed, crushed under the truck, and one young child or young boy, 9-year-old, survived with serious injuries. It was the latest incident. But last year, a Muslim sitting outside a mosque in one of the suburbs of Toronto was actually killed by a white man who was wielding a knife. He came and he just slit his throat and killed him right outside the mosque. And as you mentioned, in January of 2017, the university student went with a gun, not one, but several guns, and he shot and killed 6 people while they were praying and 20 others that were seriously injured. One of them, of course, is still in wheelchair, incapacitated from the waist down. So you see that this kind of hatred is actually generated on social media platforms, and regrettably, the political leadership in Canada, apart from spouting various slogans, have not taken any practical steps to confront this kind of Islamophobia. Of course, it's not as bad as it is in Europe, where governments have actually openly come out against Muslims, as the other guest pointed out in Austria, the same situation in France and Germany, Britain, etc.
Right.
In Canada, it is slightly better, but regrettably, there are no laws to confront Islamophobia and hatred against the Muslims.
Okay. So we're talking about Austria and Canada. Let's go to the U.S. Between 2015, Tarapa, and 2019, there was a spike in hateful incidents against Muslims in the United States. More than 1,000 cases were reported by the media, ranging from harassment and violence to federal policies against Muslim communities. Let's now explore the root cause of Islamophobia in the United States.
Could you please also just condolate and send our sincere condolences for this family and Pakistani community, and also whole Muslim community in Canada, and also consider such attacks not just against the Muslim community, they are against the whole society, the social cohesion in the whole country, in the Western country, but also in the world, and also against humanity. The problem is when we are not taking in consideration the anti-Islamic rhetoric as an Islamophobic act, when we are just taking this as a normal hatred or a normal racism or whatever without naming it, we do not develop a strategy against this. And this is our mission and also our message for our politicians, our journalists, our media, and also academics and the civil society to take this phenomena of Islamophobia, in German we call it Islamfeindlichkeit, as a racism like antisemitism against the Jews. And we have to develop mechanism against that. And we are saying this, that the rhetoric of having just populist rhetoric in elections and whatever are leading for attacks, for a physical attacks, and also in the worst case for killing people like today in Canada and like 2009 as an example with Marwa Sherbini, the Egyptian girl or lady on Dresden in Germany. That time, the German government took more than 1 week till they named it as Islamophobic attack. And we are welcome and also appreciate that today in Canada, Mr. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his officials directly and very soon said this is Islamophobic attack and also this is a terrorism. And right. This is very important, also a message for our young people in the society. There is people, there is governments, there is laws who is protecting you from any hatred.
Okay. Now, Zafar, mainstream media, social media at times, they have kept silent on hate crimes committed against Muslims in different parts of the world. Why is that?
Well, basically, the mainstream media take their direction from their politicians. And I'd like to bring in here the atmosphere that exists in the United States, and in particular, as I mentioned earlier on, since 9/11, but even more particularly when Donald Trump was elected president in 2016, and he became the president at the beginning of 2017. So his incendiary rhetoric actually fueled the media in the United States. And so the media was basically taking that position. Even here in the case of this horrific attack in London, Ontario, although the police called it a possible hate crime and a crime based on hatred of this family's religion, Canadian politicians have called it a hate crime and Islamophobia. Yet the main Canadian TV channel, CBC, simply referred to as an incident. Now, one can begin to see that, you know, they are soft peddling this whole issue. Even while the police are saying that this is probably motivated by hatred of Muslims. So what we really have to do, and this is a challenge for the Muslim community here in Canada, that we have to force the politicians to declare Islamophobia as a hate crime in law, not simply by rhetoric, but in law. And of course, the media would then be forced to accept it and report it accordingly. Otherwise, regrettably, at the present time, the media is simply brushing aside these things and just ignore them largely. And I'm afraid that even this incident would be forgotten after a few days.
Right. Now, Taref, Zafar Bangash made mention of the U.S. government role and also media workings regarding this. Now, you tell us about the role that the governments are playing in fomenting Islamophobia in different parts of the world.
This is, of course, one of the great problems. If you have an institutional Islamophobia, forbidding headscarf, having the whole community under observation, and this would lead the media and all others to have these steps. But also, as an example from Austria, I'm glad to tell you that, as an example, with this Islam map, a lot of voices were against the government. Even the Green Party, which is in the coalition of the government, was against this. The churches, the Jewish rabbis, the students, and the intellectual were against that. That means our mission to make as a coalition partner as possible against all kinds of racism, especially against Islamophobia, and name it and clarify it and document it. As an example, till now, we are urging our members, we are urging our Muslim community to report those accidents. And till now, there is a lot of people who are attacked and do not report it. If you do not report anything, it does not simply exist in the statistic. And those messages as an essential part of the society, this would develop the better existing of the Muslim community in Europe as a part of this society.
Now, Zafar Bangash, a basic question. Where and when did this all start? I mean, where can we explore the origins of Islamophobia?
Well, Islamophobia is actually has a very, very long history. It goes all the way back to the emergence of Islam and the reaction of both the Christians and the Jewish communities to Islam at that time. But in more particular sort of reference, I think we would have to go back to the time of the Crusades, when in fact Muslims were still quite in the ascendancy, and that is where this hatred of Islam and Muslims began. And so Islamophobia is nothing new. It simply becomes dormant slightly, but if there is a feeling within the Western world that Muslims are beginning to rise up again, then this aspect of Islamophobia comes to the fore. In their minds, in the minds of Western intellectuals, Islam is a threat to them because Muslims continue to remain faithful to their basic tenets of the religion. So Muslims refuse to accept the so-called vulgar values that the West propagates. Muslim women, by and large, still wear the hijab. And so the Western intellectuals see this as a threat to their secular way of life, because their position is that they must dominate and control everything. They must control everybody's thinking and lives and so on. And Muslims obviously do not fall under that. They refuse to submit, and that is something that they are afraid of, and that's why we see this Islamophobic eruptions taking place.
Okay, Tarafa, you're going to comment on that?
I just want to emphasize one point, that this is two concepts of the Western discussion, and we cannot say these Western intellectual, all of them. There is the concept of identifying yourself, excluding the other, and the other concept is identifying the country, including the others. And the others are we, are Jews, are Roma and Sinti, are migrants, are everybody else who are building this community. And I think that we have partners on intellectual way, but also we Muslim community not yet have our place in the intellectual, political, economical, educational procedure in the country. Okay. And this is our challenge for the last years. I tell you an example. In the till the 80s, till the 90s, there were racism against all foreigners. Mm-hmm. And nobody were against headscarf. But right. Now, because that time, the headscarf women were just the cleaning ladies. You don't find them anywhere. But now we had ladies, Muslim ladies with headscarf as a teacher, as a doctor, as a professor, as a driver on the street. And this make some people who are fearing from losing their identity, as they think, from the Muslim. But right. Now our message is having this multiple identity in the society, our place are making your place even better, and not you don't need to be any fear. But the racist people, this man who killed the people today, I do not think that he was afraid from the Muslims. There is an aggressive racism which is not, which do not need, does not need any fear to deal.
Okay. Now, Zafar, there's a civil rights group suing Facebook over the company's failure to stop hate speech against Muslims, and that is believed to be in violation of consumer protection laws. Why should Facebook do such a thing? You know, so social media is not always helping the truth out, like in the case of Palestinians and during this recent Gaza escalation.
You see, regrettably, all of these platforms that exist there, whether it's Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, etc., they also have an agenda. And they target and block those opinions that seem to run counter to what they perceive to be their interest. You gave the example of the Palestinians. It's a very good example. It's very illustrative that Facebook, they set up certain algorithms whereby any comments that are favorable to the Palestinians are not only pushed down, but any anti-Palestinian comments are brought up. And even if they are not, even after that, if they are not successful, then they simply shut them down completely. So it should be clear that whatever media platforms we are talking about, they basically take their direction from their government. And regrettably today, in the Western world, the overwhelming majority of the governments in the Western world, and this is particularly true in Europe, but also in the United States, these governments are extremely Islamophobic. I know, and I must admit, that Canada does not fall under that category, but again, I would say that the Canadian government has not taken the practical steps beyond the rhetoric to institute laws that would make Islamophobia a hate crime. Only then would this menace be addressed. So the point that you mentioned about social media platforms, they take their direction basically from the policies of their governments.
Okay, Tarifa, we have only 30 seconds. If you could tell us what can be done in order to remove this misunderstanding and to get the facts out about Islam, to tackle Islamophobia. 30 seconds only.
For example, in this solidarity with the Palestinian, which make the whole politician and the whole world surprised how energy they have against those, against the Israeli government in this sense, and also for solidarity with the Palestinian.
Okay, on that note, we'll come to the end of this debate. I'm Price Tibi. Thank you, my guest, founder of the initiative by Austrian Muslims, Tarifa Baghajati in Vienna. We also have director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash in Tirana. And that's it for this debate. I've been your host, Zubair Hussain. I'll see you later.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام في قوله تعالى ولسوف يعطيك ربك فترضى الشفاعة والله الشفاعة والله الشفاعة.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated with regards to Allah's verse in the Holy Quran, soon your Lord will give you that which you will be pleased, in the Holy Quran, Surah 93, Ayah 5. This is intercession. By Allah, it is intercession. By Allah, it is intercession.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find in the very beautiful and golden conversations and dialogues of the divinely appointed imams from the household of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his family, we find that these divinely appointed imams had conversations and dialogues talking about a whole range and a whole host of different things. When we specifically talk about Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, the fifth divinely appointed imam, from amongst the many countless things which he spoke about, for he had countless students whom he put forth countless traditions, we find that he did talk about one thing specifically, which are Islamic rules of social conduct, Islamic etiquettes, the way that one behaves with each other, and the way that a human being should be